mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Real duck.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1998, novelist Walter Kern was living in Montana between novels and working as an editor for Time when he was asked to accompany a crippled dog to New York City to be adopted. It was then that Kern first spoke to a not particularly pleasant but intriguing man who said his name was Clark Rockefeller. Yes, that Rockefeller. Or so Kern thought. It was only after being arrested for kidnapping nearly 10 years later that Clark Rockefeller was exposed as Christian Karl Gerhard Schrider, not only an imposter, but now a convicted murderer. Kern's new book, Blood Will Out, is his account of being taken in by the eccentric and seductive sham. The book is part memoir, part true crime, and part expose of how class and status can be products of our own perception. And Walter Kern, we welcome you to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell us about that first conversation that drew you to New York to meet this man named Clark. What was your impression of him?
Well, he sounded like he had had a very insulated upbringing among, you know, prep schools and nannies and that kind of thing. I asked him what he did for a living, and his answer was, "I'm a freelance central banker." He said he ran the economies of third world countries from his home computer using special software and equations. And he also told me he'd never, for example, drunk a Coca-Cola or eaten in a restaurant. And he went on like this. And you might think it was preposterous, but to me, a novelist, it was first of all intriguing. And secondly, I'd met these privileged types. I went to Princeton and I'd studied at Oxford. And in my experience, they were all a little kooky. And he was no kookier than some of them. He was also pretty amusing to talk to, like no one I'd ever met. And so I made it a goal to meet him.
You're a really smart, really successful guy. Your novels, Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, have been made into films, the latter Oscar-nominated film starring George Clooney. You know, you've by this time, you've known him for 15 years. You were friends with him pretty much for 10 years. You're a journalist, and you never looked up his identity?
Well, I mean, his name was Clark Rockefeller, he said, and in about 2004, when it became more common to Google people, I put it into the computer, and I got many Rockefellers that were associated with the name Clark. There was a Mary Clark Rockefeller, who I believe was married to Nelson. John D. Rockefeller's first company was called Clark and Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
But in a strange way, I didn't expect that I would find him because he'd told me he was a very private person who kind of kept his identity off the internet. So when I saw this smoke but didn't ever see any fire in terms of direct references to him, I thought, well, he must be pretty powerful to keep himself off of these search engines. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, it confirmed for me his position and power.
But we get this portrait of yourself and other people gratifying yourself or themselves by following the crumbs left out by Gerhard Schrider. I'm looking for an example that you can give to us of how you were taken in, or maybe some of the gaps you might have noticed then and figured out now that you know who he is. Oh, okay, that all makes sense to me.
Well, the first time I met him in New York, he took me over to his apartment to show me his art collection. And there were huge canvases on the walls and standing against the walls, Pollocks, Rothkos, de Koonings, Motherwells. And at some point he said, "Do you know how Mark Rothko died?" And I said, "I think he killed himself." And he said, "Right. Yes, he slashed his wrists in his studio." And he turned around one of these Rothkos that was leaning against the wall, and he said, "Do you see these little specks back here? This is actually the last painting he was working on when he died, and this is his blood." And all of that created this sort of huge, you know, and strange narrative that I was still processing by the time he moved on to another, you know, incredible story. He had the power to capture your mind and sort of stop your rational processes. And, you know, as a storyteller myself, at some level, I really enjoyed it. And I think I may even have sort of admired his mastery, though I didn't think of these necessarily as stories. I thought of them as true anecdotes, which were maybe being embellished.
Hmm. You were taken in.
Everybody fell for it.
Well, tell me
more. There's no evidence of anybody not falling for it who knew him. You know, I went to his trial when he was found out, and person after person got up there and said, I always suspected there was something about him, you know, that wasn't right. But they'd married him. They'd hired him. They'd gone to social events with him. If people were sitting around thinking he was a fraud, nobody ever acted on the suspicion.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did marry a woman who worked for McKinsey, I believe, Sandra Boss.
Yes.
She let him manage her family's money, and she made a lot of money. Now, he did have a house in Cornish. She did have a New York apartment, which I can imagine he could use as a backdrop for being Clark Rockefeller. But how did he get to that point? Can you help complete the ruse for us?
Well, he was very smart. One thing he knew how to manipulate was the system of private clubs on the East Coast. He went to a yacht club in Greenwich, Connecticut, and you know, he talked his way into it, and he held himself out to be important. And once that club admitted him, he had reciprocity at other clubs, and he'd sort of move on up the chain. And what he knew was that you can use props and other people to create credentials for yourself that then allow you to move into a yet higher circle. He was always positioning himself and using props like the paintings and associations with his colleagues. And you know, I'm sure he used his wife's position at McKinsey to make to get into parties that, you know, high level business people and so on. Mm-hmm. And you know, our job as human beings is not to be constantly running checks on each other. You know, in the last few years, we've seen this capacity to Google each other sort of expand out of control. But that was just not how it was done before. You asked if someone knew so-and-so, or you took it on faith when they were introduced by a friend of yours. To think that somebody is a complete fraud and that all their possessions are counterfeit and, you know, that their past is made up and that they, in fact, as he was, and aren't even an American, is a big leap and not something that the mind runs to immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially if you are, if you feel like you're getting this kind of sliver, this door opening into how the very, very wealthy and powerful live. I can imagine that being quite a seduction.
It was part of it in my case, but it wasn't just that I wanted to be with him. I wanted to hear the stories that he had to tell about that class of people. And he would tell, you know, ridiculously sort of interesting stories of how Princess Diana was killed by British intelligence. You know, and there were credible rumors about that even at the time, that her car crash was, you know, not completely innocent. But he claimed to have inside knowledge. He claimed to have inside knowledge on a lot of matters. And as a journalist and a novelist, that was like catnip to me.
Hmm. We're speaking with Walter Kern. He is going to be reading and talking about Blood Will Out and his other works on Wednesday night at Writers at the Loft at the Music Hall. Walter Kern, how did you figure it out? How was his secret exposed for you?
I never figured it out. His secret was exposed for me the same way it was for the entire country and everybody else who knew him. He kidnapped his daughter in Boston after a custody proceeding. There was an Amber Alert. He was caught days later. The Rockefeller family said, we don't know who this guy is. It came out that he was a German immigrant who'd come over here at 17 years old. Then, not long after that, it turned out he was a suspect in a murder all the way back to 1985, and a grisly murder, one in which the victim was cut up into pieces. And so can you think of a bigger disparity between terrible killer and supposed Rockefeller? I don't think there is one.
Mm. Well, you went to witness the trial for the murder of John Sohus, if I'm saying that properly. How did he behave to you there? I mean, you locked eyes at some points. Was he still pretending to be Clark Rockefeller or somebody else?
In the part of the trial that was in front of the jury, he did pretend to be Clark Rockefeller. He asked the judge, in fact, to call him Clark Rockefeller. His lawyers asked the judge, and the judge refused. But he dressed as he had as Clark, in a, you know, blue blazer, sockless loafers, wire-rimmed spectacles, and he acted very gentlemanly. Of course, on days when the jury wasn't there, he was brought in shackles and an orange prison jumpsuit. But, you know, when there was an audience judging him, he played the gentleman to a T.
Well, you were drawn in by him. I wonder, Walter Kern, do you think he picked you?
Well, no. I mean, it was an accident that we met. that Humane Society in Montana was the one who said, you know, can you talk to this guy? But I think as most con men and manipulators and sociopaths are able to do, he probably within 5 minutes of talking to me knew how he could manipulate me, what sort of cracks there were in my personality into which he could get leverage and so on.
Through this process of finding out from this manhunt who he really was and admitting and realizing that you've been duped, I'm interested about the process that you went through of thinking, oh, my God, it's all coming together.
Well, you see, this book is like the story of a magic trick. First, I show you what it was like to watch the magic trick, what it was like to be in his company and be fooled by him. And then I show you through the prism of attending his murder trial and finding out what his MO was and learning more and more about him, what I think really happened. Why, for example, did he show me a Rothko with blood on the back? Well, I think it was because he was obsessed with blood. He'd cut up a body. He'd probably lived with that body for a period of weeks in this little guest house while he was digging its grave, a way to cope with his, you know, nightmarish experience of bloody murder was to put blood on art and sort of upscale the whole experience. He played games of Clue dressed up in his finery as Professor Plum, and that was also an upscaling of, I think, the horrible murder experience. So the book is really double vision story.
Well, in painting the portrait of why you were duped, you actually go even further later in the book and suggest that you are somehow complicit in his masquerade. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, this may offend some, but I'm going to speak on a much larger scale. Clark, who I have evidence and reason to believe, is kind of maybe has some feelings for the Nazi past of Germany, maybe even some positive feelings. Came from a country that allowed one of the greatest crimes of all time to take place within its borders. And though everyone afterwards claimed that they hadn't seen it coming and didn't know what was going on, digging down tells you that even ignorance is in some ways a form of collaboration. Mm-hmm. I was very hard on myself looking back on the relationship because it wasn't just that I trusted him or was gullible or was blind. I also at certain levels wanted things from him, and I wanted those things badly enough not to pay attention to his inconsistencies and his tall tales. Very concretely, I used to think, oh, he'll give me a stock tip someday, sort of some Rockefeller or inside information that maybe I can use to help me and make a wise investment. Things like that. They say you can't cheat an honest man. And I was cheated. Therefore, I must not have been completely honest. I certainly wasn't honest with myself.
What about trusting people that you meet now? Are you, you know, sort of on tenderhooks and really wonder?
Well, I'll tell you honestly. I've gone on Twitter in the last week, and there are certain people who show up on Twitter who have profile photos that are, you know, pictures of movie stars, not themselves, and don't have any followers that I'm convinced are him. You know, in jail with a smuggled cell phone trying to make fun of me. It's the kind of thing he'd do. Ever since this experience, I've seen that there is much more masquerading and imposture out there in society than we realize. And once you know that, it does put a stutter in your step. It makes you a little paranoid, and I've healed from most of that. But, you know, in this age of Facebook and social media, when people are not always what they say they are or even who they say they are, we maybe are right to be a little paranoid. Mm-hmm. Not being completely trusting and vulnerable beings is probably a wise thing at this stage in history.
Walter Kern, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You can see Walter Kern tomorrow night at Writers in the Loft at the Music Hall Loft. He's going to be reading and speaking about Blood Will Out and his other work. You'll find details and ticket information on the event at wordofmouthradio.org.